Well, this morning we are getting into the Old Testament, the whole Old Testament, all in one shot. And I know that's scary sounding because that's 39 books. That's more than half of the 750,000 words in the Bible. So how are we going to do that? I don't know. I've never done that before, so let's try. What I wanted to do, last week we looked at Bible reading and the benefits of it, why we should read our Bible, and kind of gave some ideas as to how different people approach Bible reading. Because it's the beginning of the year, some people dedicate themselves to read through the whole Bible in a year. I mentioned that my wife and I developed a Bible reading, a New Testament reading plan that if you want, I'm going to make that available for anybody who wants to read through the New Testament. But in just a little bit less than 10 minutes a day, you can read the whole New Testament in 22 weeks, I think it was. So it's very encouraging to do that. And to that end, the more I was thinking about it this week, I thought, why don't we, instead of jumping into the next teaching series, the next book of the Bible that we're going to go through, I thought, why don't we take a couple of weeks and look at the Bible as a whole? So today we're going to look at, I'm going to give you an overview. We're going to fly over the whole Old Testament in one shot. Then next week we'll look at the New Testament in one shot. And then the following week we'll look at a little bit of Bible principles for Bible interpretation. How do I interpret this passage? How do I apply it to myself? Can I use Psalms? Can I use Lamentations in my life? How does this all work? So we'll look at that the following week. So let me do this. Your bulletin this morning, or your worship folder, is actually the notes for the sermon. So you're going to want that. Let's just start with four key events in the Old Testament. Now, this is debatable. Obviously, this is sort of my opinion, but we have to start somewhere. And I think certain events in the Old Testament, and even following into the New Testament, keep getting referred to. They had huge significance in biblical history. And obviously, the first one is creation and fall. The book of Genesis, which we'll look at in a second, talks about the origins of the world as we know it, but it talks about more than that. It talks about the origins of humans. And then it gets into immediately the fall of mankind or humans into sin. Well, if you look at the whole Bible as a movie, then the fall of humanity into sin in chapter 3 of Genesis is what they'd call the inciting incident. That's what gets the movie going, because that's when the problems start. And so the inciting incident is the fall of humanity, the rebellion against God. And that's why the whole rest of the Bible is about redemption. Because what God's goal from the beginning to end is to establish his kingdom on earth and to have his people dwell with him and he with them. You see that at the end of the book of Revelation. And so the whole Bible is the story, the conflict, the problems, the challenges, and the setbacks on the road to that goal of establishing God's kingdom. So creation and fall are huge. The next is the Exodus. The Exodus is when Israel, and we'll look at this in detail in a second, Israel had become slaves in the land of Egypt. And they were brought out by God, led by Moses, into the promised land. The Exodus becomes huge in Jewish history. They always, the Psalms especially, look back to God's mighty deeds. And most of those mighty deeds and actions of God that they look back on are his mighty works in bringing them out of Egypt into the promised land. The next one is David's reign. King David is such a pivotal character in the Old Testament. Almost half of the Psalms were written by him. His reign was significant. We'll look at that in a second. Israel's exile. Israel's exile, there was actually two, and we'll look at that in a minute. Okay, three key people. This is even more debatable than my four key events. But you have to know some names. That's the way I look at it. So three key people. Number one is Abraham. That's not debatable at all. Abraham is the father of the Jewish nation. We'll get to that in a minute. The next would be Moses. So Abraham is covenant. Moses is commandments. Even people who don't know anything about the Bible, they know something about Charlton Heston going up on Mount Sinai and receiving the Ten Commandments. So Moses receives the Ten Commandments, but he actually received another 603, depending on who you ask, and a set of engineering drawings for the temple, the tabernacle. So it was a little bit more than just Ten Commandments. Next is David, which I mentioned and we'll come to later. His kingdom, David establishes the huge kingdom of Israel. And then finally, Elijah, and I really didn't know whether to put Elijah in there or not, but Elijah shows up in, depending who you ask, Elijah shows up in the Gospels, which we'll look at next week, talking to Jesus, and then he possibly shows up in Revelation at the end of the age. So I threw Elijah in there. Okay, next, let's just jump in to the Old Testament books and survey them. So, the first section, and you can see on your notes that the Bible, the Old Testament, is divided into five sections. The Torah, then the historical books, then the poetry and wisdom literature, then the major prophets, then the minor prophets. Let me give you a little background, because we're calling this the Old Testament. I have a rabbi friend who, if you call the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, he will look at you funny. He goes, "What do you mean, Old Testament?" Well, okay, so why am I calling it the Old Testament? Some people will call it the Hebrew Bible. Some people will call it the First Testament. Some people will call it the Jewish Bible. I call it the Old Testament because that's just the most common term for it. And I think it actually has some foundation because it is the Old Testament. And I told my rabbi friend that. There's a New Testament. He doesn't agree, but I think there's a New Testament that's founded on Jesus, and that the Old Covenant is old because of that. The good things of the Old Testament were eclipsed by the better things of the New Testament. The book of Hebrews in the New Testament basically, essentially teaches that, and I have no problem telling my Jewish friends that nicely. It's my opinion. It's Christian opinion. But you can call it the Hebrew Bible if you want. The only problem I have with calling it the Hebrew Bible is it's not just their Bible. I see the Old Testament and the New Testament as one book together, even though the Bible is 66 books, I get it, but it's one story. So Christianity is not something other or different from Judaism. Christianity came out of Judaism and is the completion of Judaism. So I hesitate in calling it the Hebrew Bible because it makes it sound like it's just for Jewish people, and it's not. It's for all. Okay, so this is the first, what do I have next? Yeah, the Jewish people call the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, they call it the Tanakh. The reason they call it the Tanakh, that's not a Hebrew word, that's an acronym for the three sections. The way the Hebrew Bible, the Bible in Hebrew, the way it's divided is they have three sections. The Torah, which means law or instruction or guidance, doesn't just mean law like rules, it means law like instruction. The second section of the Hebrew Bible is the Nevi'im, which is the prophets. So they group all of the prophets together. And then the last section they have is the Ketuvim, which is the writings, which is like Psalms and Proverbs and those sorts of books. I just thought you would find that interesting. So let's get into the Torah. The first book in the Bible is called Genesis. And Genesis means beginnings or origins. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are called the Torah. They're also called the Pentateuch. Penta means five. The five, Tuk means books, five books. They were written by Moses during the Exodus. So this is why the Exodus is so important. They were written by Moses during the Exodus of the Jews from Egypt. What happens, if you read the book of Genesis, that might sound confusing, but if you read the book of Genesis, towards the end of it, the Jewish people go down to Egypt because of a famine in the land of Israel. They end up staying there, and they end up becoming slaves for over 400 years in the land of Egypt. So along comes Moses being called by God to bring them out, and they wander in the desert for 40 years, and they then go into the land of Canaan that we know as Palestine or Israel today. On that journey, during those 40 years, Moses writes five books: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And these are called the Pentateuch or the Torah. Genesis means beginnings. Moses writes the, again, this is around 1400 BC. He writes about the beginning of the world, the beginning of humanity, families, sin, redemption, and probably most important to the story, the beginning of the Jewish nation with Abraham in chapter 12. That's why Abraham is such a huge figure in the Old Testament, because you have the creation account, then you have the fall of man into sin, then you have the flood account with Noah. And I didn't put Noah on here because I don't think he's as crucial as Abraham. Then after that, you have the Tower of Babel, and then you have, in the midst of what wasn't a very godly universe, you have this pagan guy, this non-Jewish guy living in the area of, I think, modern-day Iran or Iraq. God comes to him and says, move to the land that I'm going to show you. And he takes a Gentile guy and makes him a Jew. Abraham becomes the first Jew. And so he goes, he follows God's leadership, and he goes to the land of Israel. And God promises him several things. He promises him a nation will come out of him that is huge. He promises that he will bless him and make him a blessing to the ends of the world. And he promises him Haaretz, the land. The land of Israel, that piece of property, as tiny as it is, if you've ever been to Israel, you're amazed how small it is for how much news it gets. That land becomes central to the Jewish nation's focus in the Old Testament, well, and even to this day. So Genesis records that. Genesis 12 is the beginning of the Abrahamic covenant, and that's going to be important for the rest of the book. Let me say something about Genesis, because it's the most, probably the most controversial book, because the creation account doesn't seem to square with science, depending on who you ask. I'm still working on my understanding of Genesis and how it meshes with Darwinian theory and who's right and who's wrong and how much they're right and how much they're wrong. But one thing you need to understand, in Bible interpretation, we'll talk about this in 2 weeks, when you look at Genesis, don't look at it through the grid of 21st century scientific debate. Look at it through the grid of what did those Israelites in the desert, in the Sinai desert, with Moses, understand him to be saying when he wrote that? Why did Moses write that creation account? Keep in mind that those people had been out of Jewish worship for 400 years. Most of them would have been very pagan, very Egyptian in their worldview and in their religious views. So Moses writes to teach them, in contrast to the Egyptian view that the sun is God, the moon is God, that all of these different aspects of creation are God's, he's writing to say there's one God, he's apart from nature, and he created, far from the sun being a God, God created the sun. And so God is over all and more powerful than all. So he's reinforcing and now educating them in the understanding of Jewish religion. Okay, that's just a quick tidbit. Let's go on to Exodus. Exodus is a huge book, especially if you've ever seen Prince of Egypt or apparently VeggieTales has Mo and the Big Exit. I haven't seen that one. My kids are too old now. How many of you seen that movie, Exodus, Gods and Kings? Both of you saw it. Oh, actually a few. Was it good? No? 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 Okay, never mind. Never mind. You can never let Christians go to a movie like Noah or Exodus, because we'll go off on them. The Exodus is a very key moment in Jewish history, because they were in bondage, in slavery. God calls Moses, most people know the story, I don't have time to recount it, but basically God uses Moses to lead his people out to the land of Israel. Thank you. I already got the map up. Very nice. Okay, so here's a map. I don't know if you're good at maps. I love maps, so I wanted to put this up. Egypt is in the bottom left-hand corner. The route of the Exodus out of Egypt is still debated, but where my arrow goes up towards the Mediterranean, at some point below the Mediterranean, they cross over the Red Sea. Now, from there, from that crossing to the land of Canaan, you see Canaan in the top right there, Canaan, which gets renamed Israel. It's a straight shot. It's an 11-day journey. Even with a million plus people, as the estimates are that they had, a million plus people walking straight through from Egypt to Israel, it says, I think in the book of Numbers, it would take them 11 days. But the problem is, they rebelled. Whole long story to this, but they end up, because of their rebellion and their unbelief for breaking faith with God, one of the big incidents was when they get closer to the promised land, they send spies into the land to spy it out. And the 12 spies come back, and 10 of them give a bad report. They're scared to death. There's giants in the land. They're gonna totally whoop us. And two of the spies said, no, come on, let's do it. We can take these guys. God's with us. Because of that, the first generation, it was sort of symbolic of the first generation's disobedience. They complained all the way through the desert. And so God kept them wandering in the desert for four decades while the first generation died off. So that's the route. They go into the Sinai Desert. It's not clear where all they go during that time. Some of the cities are named, but basically they take that route out of Egypt. Okay, next, Leviticus, everybody's favorite book. How many of you have read the book of Leviticus? Wow, that's a pretty good number. Let me ask you this. Is this your favorite book? Raise your hand if it's your favorite book. Nobody. Not a single person. All right, let me say some things about Leviticus. Leviticus is named because the first half of the book is about the Levites, the priestly, the priests and their codes for holiness. One of the questions I have for you is, do you think any of these laws in Leviticus apply to us today? How many would say, no, none of them apply to us today? Nobody wants to go there. How many would say, definitely, yeah. How about love your neighbor as yourself? Yeah, Leviticus 19:18. That kind of applies today. You have to be careful. Some people think, Christians think that, well, now we live in the new covenant. We're not under the old covenant, so we don't have to keep the law. It's just not that simple. It's really not. It's much more complex than that. And so, yeah, some of the things in the Old Testament and Leviticus no longer apply to us today, but it's just not that simple. We can talk about that more later, but I can't go through all of this. I think one question to ask when you're reading Leviticus is, what can I get out of these laws? What do I learn about God from these laws? Just one thought. Next book is Numbers. It's called Numbers probably because it has a lot of genealogies in the beginning. In Hebrew, it's called Bumidbar, which means in the desert. All of the books of the Torah are, in Hebrew, they're named for the first couple words. Like Genesis is Bereshit, which is the first words of the book in the beginning. So Numbers is named Numbers because there's a bunch of genealogies in the first half. But starting in chapter 10, now, I know if you read Leviticus, I warned you that Leviticus is you know, tough. And then you might think, well, you said that after that, Numbers gets exciting, but the first few chapters of Numbers, you'd be like, well, what's going on here? But I promise you, starting in chapter 10, the good stuff starts. There's complaining, fights, espionage, execution, rebellion, judgment, more rebellion, more judgment, a plague, a bronze snake raised up on a pole, and of course, a talking donkey, long before Shrek. So if that's not enough to get you to read it, what else are you going to Blockbuster for? Okay, so Numbers covers a 40-year span. It covers, it has historical parts from all of the journey through the wilderness, but it's, again, they're making their way up to Canaan, up to the right side of the Dead Sea there. The next book is called Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy means second law. It's a misnamed book. It's not a second law. It comes from a mistranslation of chapter 17, verse 18, which should have said, a copy of this law shall be with the king. But in any case, what it is a sermon, or really three sermons. It's Moses. They're now on the, well, this is hard. I should have had a zoom in on the, you see the two lakes there near Canaan? Do you see that? They look really funny on this map for some reason. In any case, there's two lakes or seas in Israel. One is the Sea of Galilee, where a lot of Jesus' ministry took place. And then down south of that is the Dead Sea. Between, linking them is the Jordan River. And that's where Israel goes up to the east side of Canaan, and they cross the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. So the sermons that Moses is giving, or the lectures he's giving in Deuteronomy, take place right before they're going to cross into the Promised Land. Moses doesn't get to cross in with them. You'll have to read for yourself to find out why. Okay, that's the Torah. Let's get into historical books. Now I really have to make some time. So Joshua. Joshua is the conquest of Canaan. So Joshua, Moses' sidekick, his protege, takes over when Moses dies, and he leads the nation of Israel into the land of Canaan. Why Canaan? Because that was the land that God promised to Abraham 400 years earlier. Remember I said Abraham is a key to this, and the Abrahamic covenant involves the land. So the land is always going to be the focus of Israel's life, and God's judgment and punishment of them often involves casting them out of their own land. So now they're finding their way back in. They're told by God, go in, conquer all the nations, and take over the whole nation. They came in, they did pretty good, and then they sort of lived in peace and harmony with pagan nations around them, and because of that, idolatry seeped into Israel. Israel's worship was 100% different than the nations around them. That's what Moses says in Deuteronomy 4. He says, what nation on earth has such holy laws or a God that is so close to them? But Israel constantly, for the next centuries, is tempted by idol worship beyond the scope of Judaism. Okay, so that's Joshua. The book of Judges, I kind of title that Israel Gone Wild, because Judges is the craziest book. If you have little kids, read, and your kids are like, they think the Bible's boring, read Judges to them at bedtime. Sometimes they won't be able to go to sleep because of it. Judges is, the catchphrase is, there was no ruler in Israel in those days. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. So you, if you've never read the book, you can fill in the blanks of how bad it got. Even, and that book has Samson, who's a Bible hero. If you grew up in Sunday school, you learned about Samson. This guy was an anti-hero at best. This guy was textured, totally. So if you read honestly through the book of Judges, you're like, man, this is a mess. It really was a mess. Book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is a great little book. This is Ruth is the great-grandmother of King David. She's one of only four women listed in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew. This is the story of a kinsman redeemer. Ruth comes, and she there's this law called the Levirate marriage in the Old Testament, where if a woman is widowed, then her nearest relative, or the nearest relative of her husband, needs to marry her and raise up children to his dead brother or relative. In this case, so this covers the story of how Ruth now discovers that she has a kinsman redeemer, actually two, and what happens in that process. The book is about Ruth, or possibly Naomi. You'll have to read it and find out. Next, the next books in a row here, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles, lump all of those together. Put a big circle around all of those, or a bracket, because they are different views of the same story, or a couple of different stories. Let me go through this. 1 Samuel looks at the rise of the first king in Israel. What happened is all of the nations around Israel had kings. Israel wanted a king. God said, if you have a king, he's going to be a problem. And they said, we want a king. So he raises up a king, and they get this guy Saul. Saul was basically a decent dude, but he messed up and didn't do great as a king. So this looks at the rise and fall of Saul, and then the anointing of King David to become the king in Israel. 2 Samuel is David's reign and ruin. This is a tragic story. David, who still to this day is Israel's greatest king. In this book, there's a story arc where it starts out with all of the great and mighty deeds that David does until he meets Bathsheba. Bathsheba was a woman bathing naked outside on the neighbor's roof or the neighbor's yard. David sees her, wants her, and he commits adultery with her, has her husband, one of his mighty men in his army, has him killed, and from then on, the story spirals out of control. David's one son rises up in rebellion against him to take over the nation. Somebody needs to make a movie about this, but it's tragic, but it's fascinating at the same time. 1 Kings, then, now looks at Solomon. Solomon was David's son. Now looks at Solomon's reign and also his ruin. He does something similar. He has all of this success. He builds the temple in Jerusalem. And then it says he fell into idolatry and fell away from the Lord with his 1,000, more or less, wives and concubines, live-in girlfriends. Kings back then would amass wives and horses and military when they conquered a nation. It doesn't mean he was living in a big house and having, you know, relations with all 1,000 of them, but Israel was forbidden to do that while the nations around them did it, and yet David and Solomon both did it. So this is another tragic story, because up until chapter 11 it's all success, and then it winds out of control. What happens in the second half of 1 Kings is Solomon dies. So he dies this, and under Solomon, the nation of Israel had its hugest landmass. He had peace during his years because David, his father, had conquered all of the nations around them. Solomon comes along. He's a very wise man. He asks for wisdom. God gives him wisdom, and yet he still falls into foolishness and idolatry in his later years. His son Rehoboam takes over as king, and the older, wiser men who had advised Solomon came and said, hey, here's what you need to do to have peace in the land. And he said, I'll think about that. He goes to his young cronies, and he says, what do you guys think? And they go, no, do this. And it splits the country in half, more than in half. What happens is, and what I failed to mention earlier, is Israel becomes 12 tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel. So the 12 tribes, when they went into the land of Canaan, they all took a different section of the land. Well, the northern 10 tribes break away from Solomon's son Rehoboam. Rehoboam is left with two of the tribes in the south. So the southern kingdom, now it becomes two kingdoms. The southern kingdom is called Judah. The northern kingdom is called Israel. And because of Rehoboam's folly, another guy, Jeroboam, sets up his own throne in the north. So now you have a divided country. And you have that for the rest of the Old Testament period. So that's what happens in 1 Kings. So 2 Kings now looks at a little bit later time period, and it looks at the prophets Elijah and Elisha. And they're calling back Israel to faithfulness to God. Because what happens after the nation divides? The north, Israel, becomes just plain wicked from then on. The south, Judah, has a good king and then a bad king and then a good king. So they'll make reforms and then they'll fall back, etc. So what happens then in the later period during the divided kingdom, God sends Elijah and Elisha to be prophets to call the nation back to faithfulness to God. And they keep not following or coming back to the Lord. And finally, God does two things. And let's go to the next map. What happens during this period in the 800s and then into the 700s BC, this nation of Assyria rises in the east, and you can see by this map, all of that green is Assyria. They took over all the way from Iraq and Iran down to Egypt. And so it was a huge, powerful nation. And what God did in 722 BC, he brings Assyria down into the northern section of Israel and hauls away a bunch of the Israelites off into captivity in Assyria, or this is called the exile. I mentioned this at the beginning. It's one of the four key events, Israel's exile. Israel's hauled away. Assyrians come and repopulate the northern part of Israel. Then, later on, let's go to the next map. In 100 years later, after Israel's already been hauled off, but Judah has had this sort of on-again, off-again relationship with God, Judah has a couple of bad kings rise up, and God brings the nation, or the kingdom of Babylon, which now had taken over most of Assyria's land and kingdom. Babylon comes in and destroys Jerusalem and hauls Judah off to Babylon, where they spend 70 years in exile or in captivity. Okay, so those are two really, really key events, because now, and that siege of Babylon came in three waves, in 606 BC, then 597, and then 586 was the final wave, when they hauled away dignitaries and leaders and even guys like Daniel, the prophet, to Babylon. So now Israel's left with a few people. The temple's destroyed. The city is destroyed. The gates of the city, all those cities in those old times were walled cities. And all of the gates were burned. The wall was destroyed around the city. It was in ruin. And what a pathetic situation now. This is now in the 500s BC. That's the situation. Okay, so let's... First Chronicles and Second Chronicles kind of go through, again, some of those stories. First Chronicles is what they call a hero story. It's a hero story of David. And then Second Chronicles rehashes the Solomon, Rehoboam, divided kingdom, Babylonian captivity situation. Let's go to the next book, which is Ezra. Ezra and Nehemiah, you can kind of circle those together because they cover roughly the same topic and roughly the same time period. Ezra and Nehemiah look at the return of Israel, or the Israelites or the Jews, back to the land. And Ezra focuses on rebuilding the temple. Nehemiah focuses on rebuilding the temple and also reestablishing worship. Again, this is the funny thing about Jewish history, but now a lot of the people who came back, this would be in 516 BC, a lot of those people who came back with Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel had no or little knowledge of their own spiritual history or heritage. And so they reestablish worship. There's one point where Ezra gets up and they spend almost the whole day reading the Bible together, reading the Torah, standing. So if you think my sermons are long, Ezra went for like 5 hours. So they reestablish worship in Israel, and that leads into the last section of Jewish history. But before that, let's look at the book of Esther. It's one of the most fascinating books in the Old Testament. God raises up Esther, this woman. She probably lived in the 400s BC. We're not really sure. Raises her up to come against basically she saves the Jewish race. It's a fascinating story. It's been called a biblical or a literary masterpiece by biblical and secular sources because it's written so well. One thing about the book of Esther, it's one of two books that don't mention God, which makes it interesting and controversial. Anybody know what the other book is that doesn't mention God? Sorry? The other book is Song of Solomon. How many of you have read the Song of Solomon? So that's the book of Esther without getting into more detail. Let's go on to the next section, the poetic and wisdom literature. Five books make up the poetic and wisdom literature. The book of Job. How many of you have read Job? How many of you have Job as your favorite book in the Bible? Okay, we're starting to get some. Yeah. Job is a fascinating book. Job is allowed by God. Satan says, oh, Job just worships you because you've blessed him. He was really rich. He had great family, had everything going for him. And so God says, well, I'll allow you to, you know, to come in and bring persecution and problems, but you can't touch him. And so he does. Job, the whole thing ends up being a conversation between Job and his three friends about, well, Job, you know, nobody suffers without being a sinner, so what'd you do? And he's like, I didn't do anything. And so it goes like that. And then, fascinating, towards the end of the book, this mysterious character named Elihu shows up. You can figure out who Elihu is when you read it. And then finally, at the end of the book, God speaks. Fascinating, fascinating book. The next is Psalms. I'm sure most people have read Psalms. How many of you have Psalms as your favorite book? Psalms is your favorite book, yeah. Psalms is a book of worship. Like I said earlier, half of it was written by David. Psalms is really real and gritty because David and other authors, but especially David, is just going to be straight up. Why do the wicked prosper and I suffer, Lord? What, keep my enemies from attacking me and taking me down. Where are you, Lord? I can't find you. And so what does he do? Like, especially in Psalms 77 and 78, he's depressed. He can't figure out where God is, why things are going so bad. What does he do? He says, I will remember your deeds of old. And what does he go back to? The Exodus. He goes back to see how God showed himself mighty on behalf of Israel, because what happened during the Exodus was God's hand appearing, his mighty deeds appearing in Israel. Next is Proverbs. Proverbs is wisdom. These are generally true statements. Proverbs are not promises. We'll talk about this when we talk about genres in a couple weeks. Proverbs are not promises. You can maybe take a promise out of there, but they are generally true statements. Like, he who hesitates is lost. Is that a true statement? Depends on the context. And that's what the Proverbs are like. Because if he who hesitates is lost is a promise, then what do you do with look before you leap? Because they're contradictory to each other. They're generally true statements. That's what Proverbs are. Next is Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, probably written by Solomon after he fell into idolatry, is a look at the emptiness of life without God. It's more than that, but it's at least that. Song of Solomon, don't read that until you're 18. They actually didn't let Jewish young men read it before the age of 30 because, well, I mean, this was before they had, you know, YouTube, but that would have been considered pretty graphic back then. The writer is talking about her lover, and then there's conversation back and forth, and they don't really hold back. It really is a book of love. So next section, the major prophets. Now, the prophets are divided into major and minor, partly because the major prophets are longer books, except the book of Daniel is a shorter book. Major prophets might be considered major because of their influence, but in any case, these are called the major prophets: Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Isaiah talks about Israel's future restoration. Isaiah is writing right around the time of the Assyrian exile. So when Assyria came in and took away the northern kingdom, that's when Isaiah lived. And he's writing about, yes, God is judging. This is a pattern, by the way, that you need to see, and it gets exhausting when you read the prophets. Israel disobeys. God says, I'm going to bring a foreign nation to judge you, and he does. So he brings in Assyria, he brings in Egypt, he brings in Babylon, and they come in and they will destroy or conquer Israel. Israel will be scattered, and then God promises future restoration. He always promises future restoration. Some of it is immediate, so that what happened after the Babylonian captivity in the 500s, when they all came back in 516, that was a fulfillment of certain prophecies in Isaiah and other prophecies in other prophets. But what's interesting, and you need to see this strand that goes all the way through the major and minor prophets, and that is ultimate restoration of Israel. That is what's called the New Covenant, especially in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. God promises to restore Israel, national Israel, in very glowing terms. And that hasn't happened yet. Now, this is a divide in theology. Some people think the church has replaced Israel. In fact, a lot of people in a Presbyterian-leaning church like ours would believe that. I don't believe it. I think there's a future for national Israel. I think you can see that pretty clearly, especially in Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, and Daniel, actually. But in any case, future restoration is promised, and the new covenant is promised. Just not enough time to cover all of that. Okay, Jeremiah lived during the Babylonian captivity. He stays and is left behind in that depressing town of Jerusalem that's been destroyed. Which also leads into Lamentations. Jeremiah wrote Lamentations. It's a lament over, it's almost as if he's walking amongst the ruins of Jerusalem and saying, wow, look what you've done to us, God. And we deserved every bit of it. And then God is speaking about ultimate restoration of Israel. Next, Ezekiel. Anybody have Ezekiel as your favorite book? Yeah, I knew this guy. He didn't go to church. But somehow we got on the topic of Ezekiel, and that was his favorite book. How many of you have read Ezekiel? Ezekiel has the most graphic verse in the whole Bible. Sexually graphic, X-rated verse in the entire Bible. But anyway, this guy said that Ezekiel was his favorite book. Ezekiel is brutal, grim, brutal. God is harsh. The language God uses to describe Israel's idolatry, well, what the image that's often used is that of sexual or marital unfaithfulness. So God calls Israel a whore. She is considered the adulterous wife of Jehovah. So he calls her a whore. And then he uses words to describe, using that analogy, to describe what she's done with foreign gods. Brutal, grim book, and yet restoration and hope at the end of it. At the end of Ezekiel, Ezekiel sees a vision of a restored Jerusalem and the temple and living waters flowing out of the temple. Jesus said, I am the living water. Restoration is always in view. Then Daniel is a prophet that stands all on his own. The first half of the book is the story of Daniel, some of the most famous Bible stories, Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who are not going to bow to the king, thrown into the fiery furnace. Some of the greatest Bible stories in the whole book. And then the second half is all these visions that nobody understands. But actually, what he does in those visions is he shows human history from his period on, actually from a little bit before until, depending on your view, till after, and then shows the promise of the future Messiah coming and the people of Messiah. Fascinating book. Finally, the minor prophets. We're going to run through this pretty quickly. Hosea, again, judgment and restoration is the key theme. God calls him to marry a whore. You don't get that in a lot of dating series teachings these days. But God has Hosea marry a prostitute to symbolize God's marriage to Israel and Israel's unfaithfulness. This is where we get the phrase reap the whirlwind in English. A lot of phraseology in modern English comes from the Bible. Next book is Joel. Joel uses a phrasing day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is the day of the Lord's coming and judgment. Amos. Amos was a southern prophet from Mississippi, probably, with that name. Sorry, too quick for you. Anyway, Amos speaks of the day of the Lord and also judgment and restoration. Obadiah is interesting because it doesn't prophesy God's judgment on Israel, but Israel's neighbor, the land of Edom. Jonah, how many of you read Jonah? For how many of you is that your favorite book, Jonah? Jonah's a fascinating book. You get the VeggieTales version. You get your sense of what the story is, that this guy was just a rebellious prophet, and yet at the end all this great success happened. Because how does the story end? the people he didn't want to go preach to, he finally did go preach to after he ended up being whale vomit. He says, okay, I've had a change of heart. He goes to Nineveh. He preaches to Nineveh. What happens? The whole city goes crazy for God. They all repent in sackcloth and ashes and become followers of the God of Israel. And Jonah's so excited about that, right? No, he's depressed and he's mad. Well, you have to read the book to find out why. And so the tragic story of Jonah is followed up later on, but the next book is Micah. Micah, Judgment and Restoration, but there's a couple of verses in Micah that are really famous, including Micah 5:2, which talks about where Messiah, where Jesus will be born, and Micah 6:8, he has shown you, you know, oh man, what is good, and etc., what the Lord requires of you. Next is the prophet Nahum, or however you pronounce that. This is a sequel to Jonah. I don't know if you knew there was a sequel. It's sort of a sequel because it talks about the coming judgment of Nineveh. The interesting thing is that Jonah lived around 782 to 753, so the mid-700s is when he prophesied. In 612 B.C., and I don't say BCE because it just seems so self-conscious, but in 612, Nineveh is conquered and destroyed, so whatever revival took place was not lasting with them. Next is the prophet Habakkuk. He questions God's judgment or God's justice in not judging the wicked, and then God changes his mind. Next is Zephaniah. Talks about the day of the Lord and the judgment on surrounding nations and ultimate restoration of Israel. The next one is Haggai, which I just can't help saying Haggai when I think of this. Haggai and Zechariah lived around the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. You can draw a line between Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai and Zechariah, these two prophets. These were prophets who spoke and encouraged Israel on their return from the Babylonian captivity. Finally, Malachi. Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, and by time frame also was probably written in the mid-400s. A lot of reference to Messiah and a final reference to the coming of John the Baptist, which he says, I will send Elijah before the coming of Messiah. Okay, here's where we're at. This took way longer than I expected. I have another section called Why We Read the Old Testament. What we'll do is break for lunch and come back at 1. No, I'm kidding. a lot of you are like, I'm watching Dallas Green Bay today no matter what. So what we'll do is I want to add this on to next week's message because I want you to see why to read the Old Testament. Most Christians read the New Testament to some degree and ignore a lot of the Old Testament, at least as far as their regular daily reading. And I want you to be encouraged to see why we read the Old Testament and the value of it. But let me do this. Let me pray and we'll continue with worship. Lord, I thank you for giving us your word. Thank you for the scriptures that you saw to it, were written down for our learning and for our instruction. And I pray that we would be inspired. I pray as the more we get to understand the big picture of the Old Testament, the more we would want to dive in for ourselves and read and learn and benefit from it. In Jesus' name, amen.